Welcome to episode 8 of Super Entertainment Presents, the television crossover universe on the Grand Geek Knoll Network, coming to you from Castle Wolfenstein, hosted by the TVCU crew. Tonight we have James Boyachek, CEO of 18th Wall Productions, with us, and I am Robert E. Ronsky Jr., author of the Horror Crossover Encyclopedia. We are the TVCU crew, minus one. Ivan, still a week later, is battling the cold miser, so could not be with us. So what is the television crossover universe? The television crossover universe is a shared fictional reality in which television series, films, comics, novels, video games, and more are demonstrated to coexist through crossover connections. More on the TVCU concept can be found at televisioncrossoveruniverse.com, in our Television Crossover Universe Facebook forum, in a series of Television Crossover Universe books, and now in this podcast. This podcast goes beyond the TVCU by bringing on guests whose work relates to crossovers and expands shared realities. Welcome back, James, for another week.
Huzzah.
Huzzah. Hopefully this week I can talk a little bit better. Me English be good.
Okay, no. New rule. You start talking bizarro speak, you're stuck in it the rest of the episode.
Oh, no. No, then I would just mess that up. I can't even do proper bizarro. So, shameless plugging time. James, what you got for us?
Oh, nothing out new this week, but From the Dragon Lord's Library is still available, and so is Heidi J. Hewitt's Sherlock Holmes novella, The Curious Case of the Clockwork Doll. Actually, I take that back. In just a few days after this episode, you will be able to buy the second in our monthly installment of the Sherlock Holmes novellas, The Door of Eternal Night by Josh Reynolds. Ooh. This is one of his Royal Occultist stories, and crosses over so many fantastic things. Sherlock Holmes, Royal Occultist, and, of course, two of the main characters in this adventure are Harry Houdini and Conan Doyle himself.
Nice. So for my shameless plugging, actually I just want to shamelessly plug the crowdfunding for this podcast. We do seek donations. You can donate via our website, televisioncrossoveruniverse.com. When you donate just $25, you are literally paying for a whole episode to happen. And unless you ask us to keep you anonymous, we will mention you at the end of the episode as a sponsor of this show. We really appreciate all the support we've had so far in getting support. When you donate, you really are a part of this podcast, and we really appreciate it. So that's about all for shameless plugging, and maybe a little shameful plugging. So we'll be back in a few minutes with our guest tonight, Super Geek Girl Janet L. Hetherington, and we'll be right back. And we are back. Tonight we have with us Janet L. Hetherington, author of Kolchak and Honey West, The Secret Loves of Geek Girls, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and so many other great crossovery things. She's also a filmmaker and actress. She's also written Jesse James Lawman, The Last Outlaw, The House on Arch Lane. She's also a bit of a Superman fan, which really has me excited as the proclaimed greatest Superman fan of all time. So I'm really excited to have her on the show. Janet, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate being here.
Yeah, so getting right into it, when I first wanted you on the show, it was because of Kolchak and Honey West. And then I had to look you up, and I found out how awesome you are beyond that.
thank you.
But to get started, I will ask first about the thing that originally prompted me to come across your work. How did the idea of Kolchak and Honey West come about?
Oh, that's a really good question. Actually, I can't take credit for that because at the time, my boyfriend, Ron Sutton, who's a fantastic artist, I have to say, was working on the Honey West comic book, which, of course, was published by Moonstone. And Moonstone had the license for Honey West, and which, of course, is based on the 60s series with, yes, with Anne Francis. And they also had the license for Kolchak, the Night Stalker, which I'm a huge, huge fan of Kolchak, a huge fan of the X-Files, of course, which was spawned from Kolchak. So Ron, you know, got the idea in his head, you know, well, maybe this would be a really good crossover. And so he pitched it to the editor. Fortunately, he also said, you know, my girlfriend Janet and I worked together a lot on the Elvira comic book, which we did. I wrote a lot of stories which Ron drew. And so when he first approached me and said, would you be interested in doing this, it was so funny. It came to me right away, you know, what we should be doing. And one of the key things was we had to resolve the time difference because Honey West was set in the 60s and Kolchak, of course, was in the 70s.
Right.
And so we decided, after conversation with Moonstone, that we'd set it in the 70s, so Honey would be a little older. She'd still be, you know, dead sexy.
Right.
But Kolchak would be the young cub reporter. So it's a very young Carl Kolchak that we see in the comic story. And that was really fun for me to write because it's like you're delving into a new part of this character.
Yeah, I loved it. It was a prequel for Kolchak.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I love that it took place in that time period. Instead of, it's very easy to just say, okay, modernize it, place them both in the present, a reboot type of thing. But, you know, you really kept the story true to the periods. And I, as a fan of both, I I really appreciate what you guys did there.
Well, I'll tell you... there was a lot of research that went into it. And frankly, it's the kind of research I love because it meant watching stuff.
Right.
Hours and hours of stuff and, you know, getting to rewatch stuff because, of course, we've seen it. But Ron was always very meticulous. And whenever he's working on period pieces, and he loves working on period pieces, he tries to get as much authentic reference material around as possible. And in this case, he had been doing, as I said, he had been doing Honey West. He'd been drawing Honey West. So he had all these catalogs, Sears catalogs from the 60s.
Mm.
And so he had this all this material. So when he was drawing the hotel room and he's drawing the buildings and the cars and all that stuff, he has reference material from that actual era to draw on. And so that I think that sort of really gave it an authentic vibe, as you were saying. And also, I had to work with three different editors on this crossover book.
Wow.
We had actually it was really good because when I first did my outline, there was one scene in the story where a car, a mysterious car, is trying to hit them when they're starting their investigation. And I, in the original first draft, I had Carl Kolchak pushing Honey West out of the way. And it was funny because it really wasn't working. And then it was the editor who was working on the Honey West comic, you know, made the note saying, look, who's the hero? Like, who's the more mature hero here?
Right.
You know, at this point, it's Honey West. She's already been solving crimes and whatnot. So it made more sense to have her push him out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you flow into the rest of the story, it really made sense because she was his mentor,
right.
You know, in this story. So there's some traits of Carl Kolchak. He considers himself a ladies' man. Obviously, he's so young, but at the same time, he's sort of got this bravado, and he's still finding his way. He's learning, and. And he's doing some silly stuff. And he's a bit of a coward. And this is something that we also played up a bit. You know, he's not the typical superhero type of character, which is also fun to write because superheroes are fun to write. But it's fun to write more ordinary people,
right.
Solve mysteries, and all of that stuff.
Nice. So switching gears, I wanted to.
Sure.
Talk about, I've heard a lot of buzz about The Secret Love of Geek Girls.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that book is?
Absolutely. This is an anthology. It was brought out by a wonderful editor, Hope Nicholson. She's a fellow Canadian. And she had this vision to sort of tell the stories of women in the genre, women in the geek world. Mm-hmm. And she'd read a lot online about guys saying, oh, I can't get dates, girls don't understand me. I mean, the Big Bang Theory, right? It's
sort of
like you've got all these geeks and a penny across the street doesn't get it. But I know that I always would say, wait a minute, I like that stuff too. Mm-hmm. And Hope would say, I like that stuff too. So she sort of approached a whole bunch of different female creators online and was able to do a Kickstarter to get this book going. And the response was incredible. I don't remember exactly how much she was asked for. I think it was like around $32,000. And she made over $100,000 on Kickstarter for this book. There was so much interest in it. And part of it, too, was that in the course of her soliciting contributors, Margaret Atwood, who is one of our very honored authors here in Canada, revealed that she actually has a huge love of comics and loves to create comics herself. So she actually has a comic strip in the book.
Nice.
So this was a wonderful coup for Hope. She was able to bring in a whole bunch of other contributors as well. So it's a really, really good book. And what's interesting, I was at the launch in Toronto in December, and so it is out now. But Dark Horse has picked up the publishing rights, so it's actually going to be coming out in October 2016 with a new cover under the Dark Horse banner. So it's going to get a wider reach. Right now, I know all the Kickstarter supporters have their copies, and there are some bookstores and whatnot that are carrying it. But to go into it right now, I don't know if you can walk into a comic book store and find it. But in next October, you will be able to. So I think I'm really excited that it's going to have that reach as well. And it was fun for me because I was able to do a prose piece, but then do some illustrations for it as well. Which I hadn't been drawing a lot because I'm focusing on a lot of the screenwriting.
Right.
And so to flex my creative muscles, both writing and doing some illustration, it was a lot of fun. And I was able to go back to my love of romance comics and do a romance parody type of thing as well for that particular piece, which was called Both Sides of the Table and Between the Sheets. I had one person say to me, because some of the stories are very personal, and mine was personal, but because my background is in journalism, I sort of took a very factual view or storytelling. I tried to make it funny, too, but somebody described it as my origin story, which I thought was pretty accurate because it talks about how I got in, how I brought my love of comics into my writing and my art and all of that stuff, and now doing the films and stuff. So, yeah, so Secret Loves of Geek Girls. I've heard a lot of guys have really enjoyed it, too, because it sort of gives, I mean, if you're into fandom, you're going to like the book.
Right.
You know, because it's the audience, whether it's from a female perspective or a male perspective, you're going to understand where it's coming from.
That's awesome. You know, I'm really, really happy to hear about Dark Horse picking it up. Even before I realized that you were connected to it, I'd been hearing about it for a long time. Through various places and seeing links and the Kickstarter and everything. So I gotta say, I don't want to talk about your age by asking when you grew up, but I know okay. that when I grew up, it seemed as if geek girls did not exist. They did not exist in my world. My mother used to tell me that I'm never going to meet a girl who likes comics. do you think the geek girl is a new phenomenon, or have they just been always there and just hiding in the closet?
Oh my gosh, that's a really hard question for me to answer, because I've always been a geek girl, and honestly, I have no problems with my age. I mean, I remember Star Trek being on TV, the original Star Trek, and I was a huge Trekkie from day one, huge. I mean, to this day, speaking of the closet, I mean, I've got 3 Starfleet uniforms.
Yeah.
But awesome. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, all, well, I got to say, when I was in high school, I was sort of the outcast. I mean, I guess for guys, it's the same thing, right? I mean, if you're a geek, whether you're a guy or a girl, I was on the school newspaper, and I did a cartoon strip for the school newspaper, and but I wasn't the popular girl. I wasn't the one that's being asked out on dates.
Right.
But I mean, I loved genre so much. I loved reading science fiction. As I said, I was devoted to Star Trek. I loved Mr. Spock. I think everybody loves Mr. Spock. And I did have a girlfriend who was a fellow comics fan. I was a DC diehard, and she was a Marvel fanatic. And we used to, I grew up in a small town called Wallaceburg, in Ontario. And we used to go to, she lived on a farm, her name was Lee Brown. We'd go to her home, go upstairs, and I'd bring my pile of DC, and she'd bring her pile of Marvel, and we'd sit there. And I mean, it really was a house war, you know, DC versus Marvel. But I mean, the fact that we were able to swap comics and discuss the different characters and everything, and it was another girl. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I think to answer your question, I think we have been always here. Obviously, I mean, I know a lot of women who write horror, who write science fiction, who, you know, I don't know, who love Star Wars, you know, I mean, and going back to the original Star Wars. So I don't understand where this idea came from that women don't like these things. In The Secret Loves of Geek Girls, I did a cartoon, which my colorist thought was hilarious. It's a woman, and she's standing there, and she's in a cosplay outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And she's looking at her boyfriend, who's in full football gear with the painted face and the big shoulders and the football and everything. And she's sitting there, and she's saying, "You're going to tell me about cosplay and being obsessed?" You know? I mean... I'm sorry, guys. I mean, when you get in your sports get-up and do your thing and everything, I mean, I think we all have our passions, and I think it's wonderful if we all can embrace them and we can recognize that passion and really appreciate, you know, like, just give people the room to enjoy their passions, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And I think... It's just, I think between the internet and all the conventions that are out there now, geekdom in general is just more widely accepted. And, you know, when I was a kid, it was like 2 or 3 of us, you know, that were into, you know, sci-fi and comics and stuff. And it wasn't until the internet came out that I was like, oh my God, there are others like me.
Yeah. Well, when I was growing up, after I left Wallaceburg, I went to Carleton University, and I actually helped put together a science fiction and comic book convention called MapleCon, which was one of the first ones in Canada. And that was because it was directly stemming from the fact that I wanted to pursue those interests, and we needed a forum to do that because the internet didn't exist at that time. And the friends that I've made over the years, I love conventions. I just adore conventions. I was going to San Diego Comic-Con when it was small.
Right.
It's changed so much. But, you know, I love the fact that there are local conventions now that I have a lot of people, I have a day job, and I have a lot of people come up to me and they say, you know, like, oh, you know, are you going to Comic-Con this year? And they're thinking of San Diego, and I'm saying, well, I'm hoping to, but I can tell you there's one, you know, that's happening locally in May that you can go to, so, you know, you don't have to pay or try to fight to get the hotel and the tickets to go to San Diego. You can go and experience it right here, find out if that's what you like, and then you can decide if you want to go to the bigger shows.
Right.
And they're everywhere now.
Yeah, my hometown, Smith College is in my hometown, Northampton, Mass., which is all women's college, and they have a Conbust sci-fi fantasy convention with a theme of like women and comics, women and sci-fi, and stuff like that. And it's been gaining popularity every year. It's pretty awesome. And, you know, I've been attending it for a few years now. Some pretty good panels. And it's just an example of, like anywhere, you know, you can find it, and it's cheaper. You don't have right. to fly to San Diego.
Exactly. Although I love San Diego, and I'm hoping to get down there this year. I've got to put it in my calendar to see if I can do it, but we'll see.
I haven't made it yet, but it's on my list. someday making it's like the Mecca, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So our podcast is an extension of our website, which is the Telligent Crossover Universe, and we cover a lot of different like crossover series. And yeah. A few years back, I had covered Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Cool!
But I was completely unaware of your series at the time.
Oh,
so I thought I was thorough, and and I missed a lot. So first off, I'd like to ask you, how fun was it to write Elvira?
Oh my God, it was so much fun. Again, I have to say thank you, Ron Sutton, my boyfriend, because he was drawing Elvira. This is the way things happen. We ended up going to a convention in New Jersey, I think it was, and we ended up meeting with Richard Howell, who was editing Elvira. This is for Claypool Comics, who had the license at the time. And we went for lunch, and Ron was delivering artwork, but I met Richard. We were chatting, and I said, how would you feel about me pitching you some story ideas? And he said, sure. So a lot of times, honestly, meeting the person really helps, and also finding out the way they like to receive material, get permission, and prepare the stuff the way they want to see it. So I did, and Ron and I were able to do a backup story, which was Web Mistress of the Dark. So it was about Elvira going crazy doing online shopping. It was fun. But it was later that I got to do more interesting, you know, like expanded stories, doing lead stories.
Right.
What was interesting about this particular series is because DC and Marvel had done Elvira's before. Marvel had done the adaptation of the movie that had come out, Mistress of the Dark. And DC did their Elvira take was more or less a House of Mystery style, where she was acting as a horror hostess, which she is, but introducing the stories, and so they were the traditional House of Mystery type of stories. But what Claypool did was they actually made her the lead character; she was the protagonist. So there was another writer that they had, a regular writer named Frank Strom, and he wrote. They were very funny stories. But when I started writing it, I was writing it, I'd like to say, from a female perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I love writing for her because she's sassy. She's very much in control of her persona. And there were certain things that we could not do because Cassandra Peterson is very, very smart businesswoman and really is in control of her character. You know, we had to make sure that... She's very animal friendly. She you know, wanted herself portrayed in certain ways. There's certain things we couldn't do. There's certain things that we could do. We were told to have her in her costume as much as possible because I mean that's really part of her whole trademark. So there were some times that I wanted to have her, you know, like there was one where it was a game show and she was in some sort of, like a German beer hostess type of thing. But basically they wanted her in her regular black outfit.
Right.
What was really fun was Ron was always saying to me, look, I want to do a story about dinosaurs. Can you write me a virus story that's got dinosaurs in it? So there was the challenge. How do I do that? And have a real story, you know, not just a concept. So we did some really fun stuff together, and in a way they were crossovers, even though the names were changed to protect the copyright.
Of course.
And they were parodies. But we did one, like, Ron really loves the old DC stuff, so we did one with sort of like the Challenges of the Unknown. We did one with the Thunder Agents. It was called the Windy Agents. I did one that I wrote that actually John Hebink drew. That was a takeoff on the The TV show, the one, the one about the island where all the people are on the island. That was
Lost?
A reality show. Pardon me?
Survivor?
Survivor,
yeah.
That's it. We called it Telecastaways. And it was, it ended up going as a backup, but like for several issues. But we were just, you know, doing, I threw all kinds of stuff in there because I love all the Ray Harryhausen stuff.
Yeah.
So on this island, all these skeletons show up and they're fighting Elvira's in a pirate costume. It was a blast because, you know, because she's the mistress of the dark.
Right.
You could bring in all these macabre elements. It was funny. One of the things I was told was I had to have a joke panel. Richard Howell's a very literary guy, so he really appreciated good writing, you know. He was really excellent at conveying notes. Like if something needed to be adjusted or whatever, it was a wonderful working experience. So I really enjoyed my run on Elvira, which was considerable. It was like 6 years I was working on that.
Yeah, on Comic Vine, I looked it up, and it was like a lot. years.
Yeah, and you know, it was a fun book. It was a black and white though, you know. So I mean, I don't know how. I know people do search it out now, like when we're doing conventions, Ron and I, you know, come up and say you have copies and whatnot. So, you know, if you do have a chance to read it, I really encourage you to, because it was a lot of fun. And I liked writing this really strong, sassy woman. It was just a blast.
Yeah, Elvira, I mean, I love Elvira. Just anytime she does a cameo on a show or a commercial or anything, she's just a great character. And I love that mix of the horror and the humor and, you know, and she's very confident about who she is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it just snaps. She's just there. It's great. And speaking of crossovers, I don't know if you remember the show Medium. Do you remember that show?
Yes, yes, yes.
And they had a wonderful opening. She'd be in bed, and then she'd wake up, and she'd have her story or the, you know, whatever case she had to solve. There was one time when it's Elvira pops up.
Oh.
In the
on the show, on Medium?
On Medium, yeah.
Oh, I have to find that.
I'm positive. I'm not recalling correctly, but I'm positive. And, of course, in The Simpsons, they've got their own Elvira.
Right.
So, yeah. She's a real popular. She's really very, very iconic. You know?
Yes, she is. So I've discovered that beyond writing, you've now gone Hollywood.
I don't know if I'd call it Hollywood.
So how has the transition to film work been?
Yeah, it's been great. It's something I've been wanting to do for a long time. And well, I mean, I started doing it in 2008, which just tells you how long it takes to get anywhere when you're changing direction. It was so funny. In 2008, I had done something called the Comic Book Challenge, and I had created this concept called Monster Love, and it was a competition through Platinum Studios, and I'd done okay with it, but I was starting to hit my head because I'm thinking, why am I doing this? Frankly, I mean, yes, I worked on Elvira, but I mean, you go to comic book conventions and they flock to the people who have worked for DC and Marvel.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I'm a very small fish in that pond. Which is fine. I mean, I always look back and say, I really enjoyed doing that. It was a wonderful opportunity, and I do it again in a heartbeat. But I really wanted to work in movies and do movies, and I guess, you know, one of the things on my list was I always wanted to be in a movie.
And you've been in a few.
Well, I decided, what the heck, I'm gonna do it. I auditioned for, I was in this one movie called M Theory where I played Mrs. Dilworth, who was the dean's wife, a very small role, but it was fun. And then I've done some background work because I live in Ottawa, Canada, and we've been having, our film and TV industry is doing very well. we're starting to really grow. I mean, we have Toronto, we have Montreal, we have British Columbia, which is very thriving film and TV communities. But we're starting to really do it here, too. And there's a fellow comic book horror science fiction fan, Brett Kelly, who I've known for a long, long time, and Brett's been doing movies for a long, long time. I mean, he's really a good director. It's funny, he started out as an actor, but he drifted into directing because he wanted to produce some vehicles for himself. But his talent, he's got a real talent for direction. So anyway, I've known him for a long time. He had this little thing where he asked local writers to take this idea and do a treatment. So I did, and it was basically a sample. So he got a 3-picture deal to do westerns. Now, why they want to shoot westerns in Ottawa, I do not know, but they do. So, what the hey, in this modern day and age, you go out to the forest or whatever, you can make anything look like anything, you know?
Right.
When I'm watching other films now, I really say, oh, I know how they did that. That's not necessarily where they say it is. And also, intercutting, you know, getting a star in there, that's... It's really interesting the way you can do things now. But so The Last Outlaw was a production that Brett was working on, a Western. And the original screenwriter, David Lloyd, was he'd done the first draft. He was unavailable to work on it for the second draft. So Brett asked me if I'd like to do it. So I did, and I immediately changed some things. I put a girl in it, mm-hmm. and I did spoof some stuff around. Part of it was that it really had to be tightened up because it wasn't a huge budget production, and so they needed to limit the number of players and the actors and the scenes and everything. So I worked on that one, but I shared the writing credit. And then the second one that came out, Jesse James Lawman, that one I wrote the entire thing, although I was given the treatment or the scenario from the beginning. So I didn't come up with the story. That was all pre-sold.
Right.
But this is a great exercise. Even though these aren't big budget films, they're real movies. And you're learning how to operate in a real environment so that if I do get another chance to do a bigger production or whatever, I've got that basic skill set to bring to the table. And I was really happy with Jesse James Lawman because I did not know. I was asked to do a couple of rewrites. He always ended up doing some rewrites. Right. And I was asked to change the scenes with the mayor because they were going to get a star or some marquee name to go in there. I didn't know who this was going to be. But this is pretty standard if you have a lower budget film. Like you use local actors, and I'll tell you, the actors they have here in Ottawa, they're fantastic. I mean, I've seen them at work, and they're fantastic. But they got for this Jesse James Lawman, they got Peter Fonda to play the mayor. So like I couldn't believe it when I heard, oh, it's Peter Fonda. He's saying my words. It's like I couldn't believe it. And then I found out that Kevin Sorbo was going to be in it. Well,
right.
it was really interesting because, I mean, again, that was Brett that handled all of that. And it's like, oh, my gosh. It's like, whatever happens tomorrow, I've got a movie with Kevin Sorbo and Peter Fonda in it, and I wrote it. So it's like, I'm over the moon. But again, it was like, I love doing the research. You have to watch a lot of Westerns. You have to... it was so funny when I was talking to Brett. I was like, "What kind of Western are you aiming for here? Do you want like a spaghetti type Western? Do you want like the 1950s sort of personality drama Western? Are we going for the really old school stagecoach type Western?"
Right.
Well, we got to look at how many horses can we get? How many scenes? Whatever. Where are we gonna? Where they have to do all the location stuff for the saloon and all that stuff, and. It was great because like this case they just wanted they really wanted a straight ahead actioner, really
right.
Lots of punching, So I got to write lots of punching. It was fun. It's a blast.
Was the Western genre something you were already interested in, or was it something like, well, I'll write it?
No. Actually, I really like Westerns. Mm. I mean, I love Quentin Tarantino. I die for Quentin Tarantino. But think about Star Trek, the way it was pitched, right? Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yes.
Come on. I love watching all genres. Westerns are, if anything that's done good, it's great. And I mean, even though the Western story is more of a American story, it does appeal to Canadians too, because we have that pioneer heritage too. We don't have the wild, wild west, I don't think. It's a little different.
Right.
But yeah, I know the Western genre, I've watched a lot of those movies and I really enjoy them.
And I know two of your films featured like real life, Western folk legends, Jesse James and Bat Masterson. Do you have an interest in the historical Old West, or?
Well, that was interesting. That was part of what was required for the contract to do the movie. Mm. They had to have some sort of real life character, even though it was fictionalized.
Right.
And with Jesse James, it was interesting because it's called Jesse James Lawman. Well, of course, Jesse James wasn't a lawman.
Right.
So part of the trick was to find a way to have him sort of keep that outlaw spirit, but be portrayed as a good guy, but still be an outlaw.
Right.
At the end, he goes back to being regular Jesse James. Right.
Right.
So it's always a challenge, no matter what story you might be given to write. In this case, it's not a story that I originated. I was given the scenario, and then I worked from there. So, I tried to. The one for The Last Outlaw, that was fun because I did a lot of research for it, and then there were some changes along the line, but and Jesse James. Yeah, I did my research. I don't know. This is not for the History Channel.
Right, right.
This is a work of fiction.
Right.
So it's sort of, let's think of it as an alternative of that world. Yeah. Yes. Elseworlds version.
Yeah, yeah. The fictional universe, which we call the television crossover universe, has many other adventures of real life people. that never happened. And putting outlaws as the hero is a pretty common trope for Billy the Kid and Jesse James and stuff as hero. Yeah.
Well, we even got some of those comics that came out, with Billy the Kid, and
right.
He was portrayed as like, a hero.
Right. they use the name and it sells,
Yeah.
Yeah. So finally, I want to talk about Superman.
Oh, okay.
And I'm wearing my Superman hoodie right now. I'm a huge fan
of wearing my Superman shirt, too.
That is so awesome. I am a huge fan of the character and the mythos in all of its forms.
Yeah.
And clearly you are, too.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, how did you become involved in putting together the 60 Years of Superman exhibit?
Oh, my God. One day I looked around my house and I said, I've got enough stuff here to put into a museum, which I still do. I keep collecting more. So the 60 Years was coming up, and there's this small museum, local museum, called the Nepean Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Nepean is sort of like a bedroom community of Ottawa. And I approached the curator there, the person that runs the museum, and suggested it. We'd made the connection because they had done something about Canadian science fiction. And I know Ron and I had been involved with that. And so when this sort of idea evolved, like 60 years of Superman, Superman has Canadian roots and his creation.
Right.
This is, and we could talk about other Canadian superheroes. So And then, you know, and as I said, I had enough stuff in my house to fill a museum. So we approached, and yeah, we set it up, and it was so much work, so much fun. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I one of the things, like I mentioned earlier, I have Starfleet costumes. I have a Supergirl costume that I've had for years that I wore at San Diego 1 year. I actually won DC Prize 1 year with Brainiac 5. Oh my God, that was such a hoot! So we the costume, we put it on a mannequin. We had that as part. I mean, it was just tons of stuff. Superman cake pans, the little rocket. I've got up on my shelf my small area now with my Superman stuff. There's a framed picture with Kurt Schaffenberger, Superman, looking down, and inside I've got a picture of me in my Supergirl costume. So I mean, there is all this stuff. I mean, of course, the comics, bubblegum cards, you name it. And then it turned out that there was another collector in Ottawa who also had stuff. So he had statues. Mm-hmm. He had, oh my God, it was just, and we contacted Leonard Kirk, who was drawing Supergirl at the time. Leonard, we've known for a long time. And he provided original artwork that we put into display. Nice. Trying to remember, there were other people too that had original Superman. Like, I mean, we had posters framed, we had all kinds of stuff. It was great. I've got pictures somewhere of it. It was just fantastic. And I mean, I really love Superman. I love what Frank Miller did in the 80s and revitalizing sort of the hero with Batman and the Dark Knight.
Right.
But then it just seemed to be that everybody was getting so grim and gritty. I'm sorry.
Yes, I agree.
Superman, to me, he, even though he's an alien, somehow he's always doing good. Right. And maybe it's a positive thing. I know that there's been some studies of him in his Clark Kent identity, and maybe because he had Canadian roots, that's why he's such a mild-mannered reporter. And then he turns into this wonderful symbol of humanity.
Right.
Even though he's an alien. I don't know. I just love the whole concept. And I love Supergirl, too, and have my little Wonder Woman area as well. A huge DC fanatic, obviously.
I am, too. I love DC better than Marvel, except for the current films.
I it's interesting because I saw the latest Superman film.
Man of Steel,
I love
yeah.
the Chris Reeves films. I know they're the special effects are a little not aging that well, but I don't know. I mean, I'll be interested to see this is it Superman versus Batman or Batman versus Superman that's coming up.
Batman v Superman.
Okay. I hope they're not going to go too dark with it, because to me, he's a good guy. and actually, that's why I really like the Flash TV show.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it's got this spirit of upbeat, you know, even though he's got all these challenges, you know, it's just like he wants to do good. And I've been watching the Supergirl, too. Have you been watching the Supergirl show?
Yeah, I love Supergirl. I think it's the best Superman show out there.
Well, it's interesting that there have been so many successful Superman TV series.
Right.
Honestly, I mean, and going back to the serial days, and then they had the 50s show, and then, I mean, there was Smallville, but there was
Lois and
Clark,
Superboy. Yeah, Superboy was pretty good, too. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, there's just been tons of them. I mean, they always seem to find a new Superman incarnation for a new generation, and I know that's really what they're tailoring the movies. They want it to be a little more contemporary.
Right. But they make them too dark, though. You know, they need to watch Captain America and say, oh, yeah, we can still make a modern hero.
Yes. I agree. I concur.
And that's what I love about the Supergirl show, is she is like so upbeat and positive. Yeah. And that, and the same with the Flash show, you know, it's very it's very Silver Age-ish, yet still modern.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so many good stories to pluck from those comics. And I guess a lot of this generation have not read them. So there's going to be new. There's going to be a freshness to it. And I don't mind them giving them a bit of a twist, a contemporary twist.
Right.
But if you keep the spirit of it, it I don't know. I mean, there was that one with the Flash of Two Worlds, and they're both running to the guy as like, you know, save me, Flash.
Yeah, they copied the cover.
They copied it, yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, like, this show was written by a fan. You could tell. You know, and the movies are written by people. It's like, I've never read a comic book in my life.
Yeah, well, it's hard to adapt, though. It, frankly, it is very, very hard to adapt. I do like, it's funny, too, because sometimes the environment is not right for certain kinds of films or television or whatever. I think that it's great that we do have this stuff on TV right now. But I mean, I wrote this script called The Infectious, or The Squid Tongue Sleepwalking Monster Apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
And it's a horror comedy. And I've been trying to pitch it around. And I mean, they really want the Insidious and the really straight horror stuff.
Mm.
And this is not. This is more of the 1980s style, you know, horror comedy that's very silly.
Yeah.
I like to write silly stuff. But I have absolute confidence that the timing has to be right. As sometimes somebody takes a chance on something and it does well, and the next thing you know, everybody wants it, right?
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, to me, I mean, what we're seeing with Star Wars, I mean, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And I just saw Mad Max Fury Road, which I thought was really good. It's funny because I'd seen The Road Warrior just recently, and I'm thinking, my God, that there's, even though there's a lot of years between them, there's not a lot of, you know, the same sensibility is there. So maybe some old school storytelling is going to come back into vogue. I'm hoping, anyway.
I hope so, too. All it takes is like one thing to make it out there and make some money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I mean, and I understand it's a business, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that's why they want to craft things that will succeed,
and
they're using their best knowledge, their best information to do that.
It's so, hard to
take
risks.
I mean, I have
risks.
A lot of respect for the industry.
It's hard to take risks, but you know, things build off of each other. And you know, the reason we have Batman versus Superman is because of the Avengers. The reason we have the Avengers is because of Spider-Man and X-Men. You know, and those exist because of the Michael Keaton Batman movies. You know, so they build off of each other.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, I was funny because I the X-Men. I've been finding them really interesting with the sort of this casting of this younger mm-hmm. cast that they're using. It's very, very interesting. Sort of does remind me more of the comics that I remember reading. So I think they're doing a good job.
Yeah, I think with this upcoming one, from what I've seen of the trailers and the pictures and stuff, it looks like they're very much modeling after the early 90s X-Men period, which was their most popular.
Right.
One of their most popular time periods. So I wish I could keep talking to you about comics, but unfortunately we are running out of time.
Okay.
And I still had so many more questions, but we do need to unfortunately wrap up. So, you know, hopefully we can get you back on the show to plug away more stuff and talk more comics because
my pleasure.
It was such a pleasure. So we're going to let you go, but before I let you go, I want to ask if you have any new projects that you would like to plug.
You know, I'd love to say yes, but I actually I mean, the big thing, as I mentioned earlier, was The Secret Loves of Geek Girls came out in December and is coming out again through Dark Horse with a new cover. Right now, I've got a bunch of things I'm sort of trying to put forward, so I have nothing, no news at the moment.
Yeah.
But, definitely, I'm writing, and I'm trying, I want to get back and do some more artwork as well, because I really enjoyed doing the artwork for The Secret Loves of Geek Girls in addition to writing the story that went with it. You have to flex those muscles every once in a while. But I also have to go back. There's a comedy that I wrote that I've been getting some feedback on that I have to rewrite. I want to, get that in the works. And all of this takes time, obviously, and you have to think about it. And sometimes trying to figure out what the heck is wrong with it. Like, it's like, I love it as it is. Why do you want me to change it?
Right.
But it was funny. The last set of notes I got, I read it, and I thought, yeah, now I understand what they're saying. Yeah, because sometimes it's hard. Sometimes you don't exactly understand why they're not getting it. So, I have so many ideas and so many projects I'd love to work on someday. So we'll hopefully
they
will happen and we'll be able to talk about it.
I hope so. I look forward to it. And where can people follow you on social media?
Oh, on social media. Oh, like the young kids?
Yeah, like the kids.
Well, on Twitter, I'm at Best Destiny, and BestDestiny. I have a Facebook page, but I also have a Hetherington Sutton Studio Facebook page. And what else? Oh, yeah, there is a Pinterest thing. I don't even know how to use that really well. I'm really dating myself here, but
my son just made me sign up for it. So yeah.
One thing about the Pinterest that's been really fun is I started a board that's all about. It's called The Writer Is the Hero.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that's a movie that has a writer in it, I put it in there. Like I do the story. Because it's like, oh yeah, okay, I love that story. I love that story because it's got. It talks about, because sometimes these stories, like Barton Fink, they explore the creative process in a very bizarre way. So, yeah, so that's fun. I always love reading stories about other writers.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Janet, for joining us. And unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to ramble on forever because I could have just rambled on with you.
Sorry about that.
No. I just was just enjoying talking to you so much, and I had so much more to talk to you about because it was just such pleasure. So thank you for coming on, and we really need to have you back on again so we can.
And I would strongly suggest that we have Ron come on too, because like he's got stories you will not believe.
That would be awesome.
Much fun.
That would be awesome.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to go to commercial, and we will let you go, and we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's about all the time we've got. James, I didn't let you speak at all during that interview.
And despite that, it's one of our best episodes. Or so, because of.
Sorry, Superman is my thing.
No, you are fine. Yeah. I did not want to interrupt that role.
So, I'd like everybody to please join us next week when we'll be talking with author Kevin T. Heim. And hopefully Ivan will be here for that one because the two of them have a little bit of a personal relationship. Wink, wink. Before we end, I want to thank our GoFundMe sponsors from this week. Dorinda Mulca, our own Ivan Schabowski, and an anonymous third donor. And to the Montecito Hotel and Casino. When in Vegas, everyone stops at the Montecito. And a special thanks to Tiny White and the Deadites for our show's theme music. Thanks to all who listened. Remember to subscribe to and rate our shows on iTunes. And always, everything happens somewhere. Good night.